Hello and welcome to the Storytelling with Puck podcast. We will, as always, start with a story.
This is a dream that I think really shows how we view transformation on an internal level. So once upon a time, a couple of years ago, I had this dream that I was wandering through the desert. And it was the kind of arid desert. There wasn't really sand. There was cracked ground more than anything. A few small dunes here and there. And I had no idea how I got there, which is quite a common theme in a lot of my dreams. I just find myself in a place and think, okay, I don't recall getting here, but let's see how I get out. And I was wandering around for what felt like absolute ages, and it all looked the same, so it was pretty hard to get out. And at some point, I can't tell you if it was minutes or hours later, I came across what seemed to be the remnants of some kind of car crash. There seemed to be just a little bit of metal skeleton of a car lying there, kind of half buried within a dune. And I saw that and I got this feeling of, uh-oh, I think this is bad. And not bad for the person who died in the crash, but bad for me. I could sense danger. So as I was thinking this, I could barely finish that thought. And then this man, let's call him, or what was left of him, came sprinting out of the dune. So it was what we would call a zombie in modern terminology. It was some kind of revenant, some kind of corpse, some kind of half-melted, half-decomposed man. And he was running really fast, though. He was not slowly ambulating towards me like in The Walking Dead. He was more like a World War Z kind of zombie. So he was sprinting like crazy. So I started running from him and he caught up with me pretty quickly. And I'm pretty fast. So that was pretty scary that this half-melted corpse was that fast. And he tackled me to the ground and he was screaming and roaring for my flesh. And I was trying to fight him off me. So I was on the ground on my back. He was on top. He was trying to claw and bite as much as he could out of me. And for a little bit, it seemed like I had him, but then I didn't, because he did manage to bend down closely enough to take a huge chunk out of my neck. So as he pulled back, you could see this ribbon of just flesh and tissue just ripping off. There was blood spurting everywhere. I was absolutely panicking. I thought, this is it. I am dead now. And as I had that thought, I recall being interrupted by, I don't want to say another thought. I would call it more like an instinct. So as I had this internal monologue of watching him pull whatever flesh and guts out of me from on top of me, thinking, this is it. This is the end. I'm done. Before I could get to the done part, I just felt this surge of power inside me, and it was almost like a locked away memory had just been unlocked. Maybe it was a final safety net in my head somewhere, like a break glass in case of fire situation. So I could feel something trigger, and it was both power and memory. It was almost as if I remembered in that very moment, as I was about to die, who or what I actually was. And then I remembered, wait a second, I'm a force of nature. That thing can't kill me. Nobody can kill me. And then I felt the warmth surge up inside me. And then I transformed, and this is where the perspective shifts, because until that point, I was viewing it through my eyes, first-person perspective. And then all of a sudden, it's as if the camera pulled away, and I could see myself and the Revenant fighting. There was a flash and I just transformed into a flock of beautiful tropical birds. You know, the ones with a long ribbon tail and the crest like a punk rocker. And we dispersed and that thing fell to the ground. It face planted and we started flying around, swarming him and dive bombing him. It was like the tropical version of Hitchcock's Birds, just a lot prettier, because we were all these electric blue and teal and turquoise birds flying around, and that thing was thrashing around and screaming. It was trying to catch one of us, or one of me. I can't even say if I was a me or an us at that point. It was trying to catch us, but we were too fast. As we were swarming and dive bombing him, we started chipping away. You could see more and more tissue, more and more holes coming off from that thing. And I knew that we had him, and I knew that this is where we/I were going to end him. So in a final fell swoop, if you want to call it that, we all flew up high, very high into the sky, hundreds of feet probably. And we started shimmering really brightly, even more brightly than before. And then we just started dive bombing him as one. It was almost like a small teal meteor hit the scene. And I remember raining down on him, that thing getting blown apart. We left a crater. And I remember the very last thing before I woke up, zooming in on his head as I was dive bombing, looking through my eyes again, and watching it pop open like a watermelon. And then, boom, I woke up. And at that point, I knew that the scary things in my life coming ahead, because it was a time of uncertainty in the real life, not in the desert, I felt like I had it. I thought, okay, maybe I'm stronger and more resilient than I remember. So I woke up after all of this, feeling a lot of hope and feeling a lot of confidence.
That's some story. That is some story, Nick.
It really is. Welcome to the workings of my unconscious mind.
I love your unconscious mind, and we're going to dig a lot deeper into it. But before we go further into your mind, a little note to anybody who is listening for the first time or anyone who has forgotten. My name is Stefano. I run Puck Creations, and I am the regular host of this podcast. If the title Storytelling with Puck hasn't given it away, this podcast is all about stories. We will share stories, we will chat about stories, and we will see how stories, even ones about zombies, fit in with the business world too. Of course, we couldn't do that without our wonderful guests. So let's start by properly introducing, and I'm going to try my best to pronounce this.
Go ahead.
Nick Diakonostasis.
So close, Diakonostasis.
Diakonostasis.
Oh, it's closer than most people get, so you get points for that.
Okay, thank you. Well, Nick, the audience can't read your mind, as you often say, so please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I'm Nick Diakonostasis, or Diakonostasis, if you want to pronounce it the Greek way. I'm a half-Greek, half-Swiss hybrid terrorizing London these days. So I've lived in the UK for a decade now, and I have an interesting trajectory, I guess. So I'm a former language teacher turned actor turned public speaking coach now.
Wow.
And I help business owners get in front of their audience and speak well, not just with confidence, but with competence, and help them connect with their audience on the level that really matters, the human level.
Incredible. That's some, I was going to say some level of change, but actually what you've been doing always is similar in a lot of ways, moving from teaching languages to now teaching speaking in front of people. Actually, there's something to languages, I believe, that help you to gain confidence in being able to understand different parts of grammar and how you have a better level of vocabulary, which I'm not displaying here at the moment. So so it makes it more possible for you to be able to express yourself, I imagine. Does that help with some of your teaching now at all?
Yeah, it all fed into each other, because at drama school, they would point out quite a bit, our teachers, that, oh, it's obvious that you used to be a language major because you struggle a lot less with Shakespeare and whatnot. No. Or, you know, Tennessee Williams or whatever. But yeah, I guess the vocabulary is more expensive than the average actors. It all feeds into each other. So that helped me grasp better that part of communication, the verbal part. Mm-hmm. And then all kinds of nonverbal and emotional parts, they were augmented by the acting training. So now I can combine both of that into my coaching right now. I definitely think both parts were necessary, even though at the respective points in my life, I might not necessarily have seen the point in doing either of those things. But now that they've come together, I think, yeah, I definitely wouldn't be able to help people as well if I'd skipped at least one of these two.
That makes sense. And so what was it that you said you didn't see the points at different parts of your life or doing either one of those things, but what was it that brought you into both of those worlds? Let's start with the language. Why did you go into that world in the first place?
Well, that part is very underwhelming, and that explains why I then move into acting, because I didn't really want to study anything. I was a straight A student. I was a teacher's pet for sure in high school. I was always top of a class or one of the top 2-3 kids. But honestly, that was more because I'm A, competitive, and two, I was a fast learner. So I didn't really put that much effort into my grades, but I somehow got them anyway. And because of that, everyone, including my parents, my teachers, were pushing me to get a further education, right? Because there's this obsession these days. And as a former educator, people sometimes get surprised when I say that I don't think everyone needs to go to university. I don't think everyone needs to study something. There is this bizarre obsession where you just have to study something. It doesn't matter if it's underwater basket weaving. It doesn't matter if it's holistic dance therapy. They just have to shove you into some kind of uni, don't they? So when I was 17, 18 and finishing high school, I didn't really have any idea what I wanted to do with my life. But I allowed everyone around me to push me into something. And I thought, what's going to be the easiest for me? Languages. Because I'm native bilingual anyway, so Greek and German are both my native tongues.
Okay, Greek and German, okay.
I was fluent in English at the time of graduating high school because I took it as an elective as well. So I thought that's going to be the easiest thing for me. I just took the path of least resistance and ended up studying language and literature, even though I didn't have a huge interest in it. I mean, I always have an interest in it, but I didn't want to do it professionally.
I see. You had an interest more of as a hobby, and also to be able to
communicate. Yeah.
But not the perspective of
taking. I love languages. I just didn't want to be a linguist. I thought, why am I doing this? And all the while through studying, I thought, why am I doing this? I don't want to be a teacher. I don't want to be a translator or an interpreter. I don't want to be a linguist of any kind. I'm only doing it because apparently this is going to help me get a better job or a job at all when I graduate.
Interestingly, it kind of did.
Yeah, it did, but in the very long term.
So what happened next? So you had gone through that, you had decided that it was something which you were supposed to do rather than something that you really wanted to do.
Yeah.
Did you do well?
Yeah, I did well, but it wasn't satisfying on a personal level at all. And I kept, the closer I got to graduation, I found myself thinking about what happens after. So let's say I get the degree and whatnot. What do I do then? I don't want to teach languages. I don't want to translate. I don't want to do anything of that sort. I still have no idea what I want to do with my life. I was very lost. So we can flash forward to 21, where I had this wild inspiration because even though I was always linguistically wired, I was also always artsy fartsy. I hope you can say that on your, podcast. And I was always good at a lot of creative stuff like painting, drawing, singing, making stuff out of Play-Doh when I was a kid. I was always good at that stuff. And I just had this wild idea, even though I hadn't acted properly before. I mean, I'd been in a couple of school shows as a background character, and who hasn't when they're 8 and they're a tree or whatever on stage?
Hey, it's a hard job to play.
It's super hard to be a tree. Yeah. When you're 8 and you want to move around and you need to sit still. Yeah. But that was the extent of my experience with acting at that point. But I had this wild vision that of all the artistic paths that I don't want to say walked, but dithered in so far in my childhood, acting is the one that I haven't really tried out. So in a moment of madness or genius or foresight, which I hadn't realized at that point, I spontaneously booked a course here in the UK, because at 21, I was still in Greece. I booked an intro to acting course here in the UK, a 3-week summer course at East 15, which is one of the big drama schools here. And I booked it and I was accepted. I mean, probably the standards were quite low because it was just an intro course. And then I came here and then it was like a revelation. I was like, I found the purpose of my life. This is what I'm meant to be doing. So by week 2, I couldn't believe that I even had a different life before in Greece. I couldn't believe that I didn't wake up every day doing, 3 hours of singing and 3 hours of dancing and an hour of fencing, stage combat and all that stuff. And then Shakespeare and Chekhov. And even though I was brand new at that stuff, and I was surrounded by people who had been interested in acting for way longer than I had, And I remember the running gag was always, oh, do you know that playwright? And everyone in the class would say, oh, I love him. I saw this show and that show. And I'd be like, I have no idea who this is. But I know that I enjoy the process of acting and of becoming a different person.
Did that make you feel a little bit less than or left out at the time? Or were you able
to? At the time, I had major imposter syndrome. Okay. Yeah, it did definitely throw me off. And I felt like, and then when I auditioned, obviously later, and I got accepted into the same school, to the master's degree, I felt like there was a clerical error. So I thought, surely not me, right? Because I've been doing this for about 5 seconds. And I also felt like I had snuck in through the back door while nobody was looking, well, as everyone else had been admitted fair and square. And for me, the thought, I don't know, maybe I'm a diversity, you know, token, like, oh, let's get a Mediterranean dude, as opposed to all the pale, frail, the pale, freckly, blonde, blue-eyed English people in the course. It will make us look more international or something like that. It took me a while to shake that feeling off when I was actually doing the proper training at drama school. I felt like, I'm not sure I belong here. I'm enjoying it, but I'm terrified that I'll be found out as an imposter any day now.
Was there a specific moment where you realized that actually you're definitely not an imposter and you know what you're doing, or did it kind of develop over time that you started to feel more at ease?
It was both. There was a gradual growth of confidence, and I started realizing that my classmates, let alone my professors, never treated me this way. This was coming from me. Okay. Nobody was looking down on me because, oh my God, you're 22, because that's flash forward another year after I auditioned and got accepted. They never gave me the impression of, you shouldn't be here, or what are you doing? They would give me good feedback, like, oh, that was really good, or I enjoyed how you did this, and are you sure you haven't done this before? And I thought, I guess they're not all lying, hopefully. I mean, English people are very polite. But after a certain point, in the beginning, I would rationalize even the compliments and the good feedback. I would rationalize it away as, they're just being polite. Or maybe they just feel sorry for you. But slowly it started sinking in that probably not all of it was a lie and politeness. And then at some point, I remember one of the pivotal moments when after each term, we would have one-on-one feedback with our head of course. It was this experienced actress and director. And she told me, don't tell the others. And I didn't until after we graduated. I kept it to myself. She said, don't tell the others. But if I had been casting for that show, because we did a show by Sam Shepard, if I had been casting for that role, I would have cast you, like if this was the real world. I was like, okay, so maybe there is something to that.
Wow, that's powerful. Yeah. As you say, that was something that triggered an explosion of confidence, then some of the small gradual.
Yeah, yeah. So that was the end of term two. So term three, I definitely came back, and a lot of people noticed that you have a way bigger head than you used to. You have this swagger and this confidence all of a sudden. It's like, before you were like, oh my God. Now you're like, huh, look at me.
Look at me, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you think that some of the reasons that people did want you around and you were able to portray yourself in a different way to other people who had got into the course, who, as you say, had been wanting to do this all their lives, do you think that actually had something to do with the fact that you didn't want to do it all your life and that you had different types of experience behind you to help you?
I do think there was some of that newbie luck and energy involved. Beginner's luck, beginner's energy, both. There was that excitement of, because the nerve of me, and by the nerve, I mean just the inexperience. So because at that point where I auditioned, I knew very little. I just knew that I was drawn to this, and it made me feel happier than anything else that I'd done at that point. So I went like an idiot, and I auditioned with the speech from Hamlet, to be or not to be, because that was one of the very few acting monologues that I knew. When they say bring a classical and a contemporary monologue, I was like, okay, that's the only classical monologue I know.
It's Shakespeare's classical, so I'll do that.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, other than that, it was just ancient Greek tragedies, I guess, that I'd done in high school. And I thought, I don't want to go that far back. And after I got accepted, the teacher who auditioned me said, you had some nerve coming with that. You were lucky that you managed to pull it off. I was like, it wasn't nerve. I just didn't know any better. So sometimes when you don't know the odds, and when you don't know what that, it's like the cartoons where they're walking on air, and until they realize that they're walking on air, they don't fall. It's only when you realize the odds and how crazy what you're doing is that you might trip up. So at that point, I had just this blind confidence of the person, or not even confidence, just this ignorant bliss, I think. I had no idea what and I do think in some ways that helped me, because I could have been even more nervous if I had known just how deep I had potentially been digging myself and just how precarious my situation was a lot of times.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I imagine if you had been in an environment surrounded by friends who had known the potential pitfalls of walking into an audition and doing the to be or not to be monologue, they would have either have put you off or at least told you that it's a really bad idea, to the point where you would have been extremely nervous, even more nervous than you already were when you were doing it. But I guess because you only had the nerves of auditioning, less so the nerves of this is not the thing that's supposed to be done.
Yeah, exactly. This was one of the things that they told us, what, you know, on the course, that there are certain things that you probably shouldn't do at auditions. And going for a monologue this big is one of the top ones. Like, don't do that. If you want to do From Hamlet, do a different monologue or do a different character. But don't do the to be or not to be monologue, because that's insane. It's been done so many times, and people will unconsciously compare you to Laurence Olivier, for example.
Yeah, that's always part of the problem. Somebody's done it before, and somebody's done it better than anybody else before, at least in other people's heads. That's the idea.
Yeah, it would be like going to a singing show and singing I Will Always Love You. I mean, you're not going to be better than Whitney anyway, so most of the time it's suicide doing that.
I don't know. If you've heard me on karaoke, I am clearly joking, but you did well. You got into the next stage of your life. You were able to do what you were now realized you loved. You weren't thinking about doing something because other people told you anymore.
Yeah.
But that course has to come to an end, right? The master's degree has to come to an end. So I'm being very linear here, but I'm enjoying the
it's full of the timeline
of it.
Yeah, I feel like we're doing psychotherapy. We're going through the timeline of my life.
And then what happened when...
how did that make you feel?
Yeah, exactly.
It was provoking all these mixed emotions in me, because at the end of term two, even though at that point I'd gotten that wonderful feedback, I started thinking about the more practical aspects of it. And I'm a deeply practical person, which again sets me apart from most actors or performing artists, who tend to be more on the, whatever you want to call it, right brain, emotional, heart overhead side. And I started freaking out about my future, because I thought, okay, so let's say I graduate here with this fancy training and this fancy degree, and then what? The odds are still that I'm going to be unemployed. If I do get acting work, it's going to be sparse. A lot of it is not going to be well paid. A lot of it is going to be free, actually, but you have to keep working, because you need to flesh out your CV and you need to show potential. You know, if let's say 3 years after graduation, you get the chance to audition for Spielberg, probably never going to happen, but you want to show that you've consistently been working, because people want to see that you have a passion for it. And there was this expectation that you would do it for free, basically, just for the passion of it. And this is something that fundamentally clashes with my beliefs, because I'm not someone who believes in allowing people to take advantage of me, which is how I saw it. So no, I'm not going to work.
Coming from working as a writer, we have the same.
Yeah.
We constantly have people say, oh, it'll be great for exposure. Can you imagine being part? We have 5 followers. You could get in front of all 5 of these people.
Exactly. It is exactly. There are very interesting... When I came onto LinkedIn about 2 years ago, I realized there are a lot of interesting parallels between the acting world and the self-employed world. I mean, technically, as an actor, you're self-employed anyway, but I never thought of myself that way. I only saw myself as a self-employed person after that point. But there are parallels where you're expected to work for free because it might potentially in the future lead to better jobs, you know? And I would have a lot of these arguments with my professors where they told me that I have a bad attitude because I don't want to do that. They said, you have the skill, but we're afraid that your personality is not going to work in this business because you don't want to work for free. You're not a people pleaser, which That was a long discussion that often the traits that make people good actors make them miserable people, and vice versa. I said, a lot of people in this industry, you've probably noticed already, they crave attention and approval. That is quite a typical personality for a performer, this kind of narcissistic streak where you really need people to like you and you need attention and approval. And I was not like that at all. They said, on a personal level, it's healthy because you have better boundaries than most of your classmates who are desperate to be liked. But on a business level, Nick, this is bad. Like, you're way too opinionated and way too confrontational for your own good.
Is that true, do you think? Because...
Yeah. It is.
I think there's definitely a truth to it, but I would love to speak to... I'd love to see the difference between actors who get right to the top and actors who... And I mean, this is, everyone has different definitions of success, but if you're talking purely what everyone sees, you get Oscars. Yeah,
Hollywood.
Yeah, Hollywood, etc. Or actors who get on stage and get Tonys, etc. And then actors who are side parts and they're not famous... They maybe have a decent enough career and they're consistently working. And to try and understand a bit more about the personalities of each of them and whether or not they were all attention seekers, or actually did some of them have a different mentality and still manage to get to the top without that narcissism, without that desperation, but actually they had the skill and maybe had some business smarts and were able to... Yeah. Who the right people to talk to, rather than begging and being desperate, they knew who it was they should talk to get to the right place. It always interests me.
Yeah, for sure. The people who get to the top, probably they have good, if they don't have a business mind, they at least have the mind to hire someone who advises them on that. Because we had modules on that, you know, that it's called show business, not show fun. So there's a business part of it. And notoriously, artsy-fartsy people tend to be bad at the business stuff. Mm-hmm. And they advise us, you know, how to do your taxes, because technically you'd be considered self-employed, and how you do this and how you do that and how you write a good cover letter and how you, you know, create a website that doesn't put people off immediately because you're talking about yourself in the third person, even though nobody knows you. So obviously it's you writing about yourself, all that stuff for sure. I think my guess would be the people who have that sort of typical, because of course it's not everyone who's a people pleaser, but it's just disproportionately high in the performing industry. I think the people who have the typical sort of please like me personality that performers tend to have are probably in the middle, and the people who are more confrontational are either, it pulls you either to the top or to the bottom. It's probably hard to be middle of the road if you're not willing to do that and play that game. That would just be my guess. It's gonna be quite polarizing. So you'll either go to the top or to the bottom. More likely to the bottom, if you have the personality.
Yeah, I imagine that talent has to take you a long way, and hard work has to take you a long way. But there's a point where people will give up on you if you're not willing to, as you say, people please, or you don't at least have the business intelligence to find out how to do it a different way. Either one of those might help. So let's go back to your story, because that's way more interesting.
So I was starting to get consumed halfway through, because the master's degree is 1 year. So after 6 months, I started getting consumed with the thoughts of, so what is my future realistically going to look like? And then I looked at the people who graduated before us. And yeah, I mean, some of them were getting, most of them were not working full-time as actors, as in it wasn't their only source of income. Mm-hmm. Most of them had waiting jobs, call center jobs, just the classical stuff that you're expected to do as an actor, you know, paying your dues and having all these jobs that you probably hate so you can finance your passion. And then at some point, hopefully, it's going to turn into something.
Then you break it big, that kind of
thing. Which obviously the odds are 1 in 1,000, I don't know, of you getting to Hollywood or even to the West End. And then I would start looking further down into the future, people who have been acting for 5 or for 10 years professionally. And most of them, with very few exceptions, still didn't have the kind of life that I wanted for myself. They still were perpetually broke. They would have to take other jobs between acting assignments. They would have to live with like 3-4 other people to pay rent. And these are people, at that point, I was in my early to mid-20s, but these were people mid-30s, sometimes even beyond that. And I thought, if this is a look at the future, I'm scared. I don't think I want that for myself.
Was this by any chance when zombies started to attack?
No, that was that the zombies came about what, 2-3 years ago? That was
Oh really? Okay, in that case, well, sorry, that's my fault. I've cut in too early. We'll get to that a bit later.
Right? Yeah.
I felt like this was a zombie moment, but maybe
it wasn't. I mean, I've been having crazy dreams ever since I was a child. So I had plenty of crazy dreams, but that particular one, no, that was, I think, 2 or 3 years ago.
Okay, really interesting. You know what? We're there now, so I'm going to dive into it. We're going to come back to your story after we've dived into it.
Sure.
So as we've got to the zombie 2 or 3 years ago, if you don't mind talking about it, you don't have to. But what kind of place were you in? Where you said that before you went to sleep that night, you were already in a state of, I guess, a bit of worry,
uncertainty, worry, stress. Yeah, it was. I would have to move again. Which I've lived in London for 10 years now. I've moved way too many times for that, because things just kept happening. It was either that I didn't like the living situation or that the landlord wanted to take the place back, so I had to move out. That happened a couple of different times. So I am someone who, weirdly enough, even though I'm self-employed, I do like structure and order. It's just how my mind works. So I do want to have as much order and structure as I possibly can. So if, for example, the work part is unpredictable, I want the home part to be stable. It's extra important. So the fact that I had to keep moving around and I was getting stressed, and London gets more and more expensive every year. So every time I had to move, it was like playing Super Mario, right? Where you have to jump onto the floating cubes and hope you don't crash into the lava below. And every time I had to take the jump, the cube was smaller or further away. So every time I had to move, my options were fewer. And at that point, I wasn't really doing remote work yet to any significant extent. So there were so many limitations between what I can afford, that I feel safe in that place or that neighborhood, that it's walking distance to the tube, because a lot of my sessions, so this is me being a language tutor again. So it was language teacher, actor, back to language teaching, because I didn't want to be broke forever, and then public speaking coaching. So I had so many limitations, and I felt really uncertain. I thought, I don't know what the hell is going on with my future, and I keep trying to create a more stable life for myself, but it just ends up being a Super Mario game anyway. So I think all that stuff about, am I going to find some place? I think at that point I had maybe seen a couple of places, and I thought, I mean, I don't hate them, so maybe I'll have to take them, because most of the stuff that you see in London that you can afford, you'll just hate flat out, right? So if you don't absolutely hate it, there comes a moment where I think maybe I should just leave well enough alone and take one of these places, because if I think about it for too long, these places that I just feel okay about, they're going to be gone too. Anything that is not awful gets snapped up immediately in London. So I went to sleep with all of that stuff brewing around in my head, and then I dreamt of some kind of transformation and rediscovering some kind of dormant strength that I had. So that was fun. I woke up a lot calmer.
It's interesting that you woke up a lot calmer after dreaming about zombies, but to be fair, the end of your dream is positive.
Yeah. But, maybe I've got this under control. Maybe it's not going to be as bad as I thought.
Do you think many people go through such distinct journeys in their dreams, because often people say they have a nightmare, or they say they have a very positive dream, and positive dream is, you know, something glorious, flying, maybe blue skies around them, lying on a beach, whatever it is, and the nightmare is potentially zombies or ghosts, or actually maybe something more real that's happened in their life, and they're picturing a version of reality in their dream. You seem to go from a nightmare to a dream within the scope of one evening. Do you think that's common practice? Have you looked into this at all?
Most people that I mean, I don't discuss my dreams with that many people because I want to maintain a mask of sanity. Most people probably not. Either they don't. It's more static, as in you said, it's good or bad. Or they do, but they just don't remember it, because apparently we don't remember most of our dreams. So maybe they do, but maybe that's just not the point that really struck a chord with them. So that's not the point they remember.
That's a good point. It's interesting, because something I find is there's the very common notion that when you go to bed and there might be thoughts on your mind, and when you wake up in the morning, they've disappeared and you feel better. Now that could be purely because you slept, you've re-energized all of the physical. But also I wonder if sometimes there is something to the dreams that you have whilst you sleep as well. And I have to say, I am very much guessing. There is no expertise going behind this whatsoever.
Yeah. I'm not a psychologist either, although I do know a couple of psychologists as friends. You probably do, even if you don't remember it the next morning, you probably do a bit of digesting and decluttering in your head. Hmm. So you wake up clear.
It's interesting. I think maybe this is something that we can put out to the wide world and ask questions and see other people's thoughts on this.
We can. I mean, when I have worries like that, my dreams tend to largely be symbolic like this. So I'm not actually going to dream about the thing most of the time. Or if it is the thing, it's going to have a massive twist on it and still going to be something like out of a Stephen King or a Saturday Night Live or both skit. It's going to be usually quite surreal. But when I wake up, I usually know that, okay, I know why I dreamt of this because this and this is... It's occupying my mind right now. Yeah, it's my brain kind of recycling the leftovers of my thoughts. I'm like, okay, what can we cook from this?
What's interesting about that actually is I find, and something we, if I'm honest, bang on about, people probably get bored, is the power of stories. And one of the reasons that we find stories to be so powerful is because of the metaphors and analogies, and how when you read a story or you see a story in a movie or on stage or on TV, etc., often there can be stories that have absolutely nothing to do with your life, but some of the feelings and the emotions that they dredge up click and make you think about your life in a different way. And it seems like you're almost doing that within your own dreams. You don't have to read a book or watch or watch something. It's in there. It's all in your head.
It is all in there for whatever reason. Yeah, I mean, something that they told us at drama school is that humans are going to human, basically. We've been the same for a very long time, for thousands of years now. That's why if you read or watch ancient Greek tragedies, which are about 3,000-4,000 years back, if you're not dead inside, they will still resonate with you, because it's the core elements are the same. It is about the same questions, it is about the same fears, it is about the same doubts, the same things that would have relieved the audience back there in ancient Athens will relieve us as well. You know, when there's a happy ending, we will all cry when the dog dies in the movie or in the story. It's the extras that change, but the basic parts are the same. And the good stories, they make it about those elements that are constant and relatable. So, for example, even a story that is science fiction or supernatural, like The Lord of the Rings, why does it work, The Lord of the Rings? Because it's still about the human element. It is not a story about magic. It's a story about good versus evil and the power of friendship and all of that. And it happens to involve magic, but that's not really what it is about, is it?
That's true. Would you say there's also something to the idea that it's about all of those things, but it's detached?
What do you mean by that?
Nick asked a really good question there. So while I think about it, now might be a good time to remind you that you're listening to episode 13 of the Storytelling with Puck podcast. We've moved from dreaming to dreams to reality, and we'll be moving in lots more realms before the end of the episode. We'll find out more about Nick's story, why he moved into becoming a public speaking coach, and how his methods differ from most. As always, there will be a chance to listen to a story from Puck Creations at the end. Now, I've had time to think. What do I mean when I ask about fantasy and science fiction tapping into our emotions whilst being detached?
What I mean is, because a lot of science fiction is based in magical worlds, in worlds that we could not possibly, well, most people don't see as reality, don't think, well, actually, I could go and be part of Gandalf's life at some point.
Yeah.
To go and ask him if he would help me out. You can't do that, but you can get a feeling for some of the stuff that's going on, the good versus evil, as you say, friendship, the humanity. Interestingly, humanity, but it's lots of different
hobbitity, whatever you want to call it. Hobbit kind.
But all of that is away from you. So you don't get the pain, I guess, of somebody talking directly to you about your
right. Life. Yeah, it's a nice bit of
metaphors to go with it.
Yeah, it's a nice bit of surrogate suffering. That's not a thing. I just made that up. But yeah, they're a nice proxy, I guess. Yeah. So you can live vicariously through them, but in a safe environment, in a safe context.
I definitely think there's something to that, which again is another reason that stories are so powerful. Mm. And what I want to do now is people do love stories, but yeah. I think they probably get sometimes slightly frustrated if they get a beginning, a middle, and don't get the bits that fill in the gaps. So we had got to with your story, your second
school,
and then I rudely decided that that was where you were talking about zombies, which I was incorrect on. So then we skipped to the moment where the zombies did matter. But what happened in between? So you mentioned briefly that you finished drama school. In your second year of drama school, you said that you were having these panics and these moments. But what did you do? Where did you go with it after that?
Yeah. By the time I graduated, I had decided that I'm probably not going to do that to myself. And I'm probably not going to work as an actor because I don't think I want this life. Then I ended up doing it anyway.
Okay.
I never managed to do it full time because here's the thing. Here's how screwed up my thought process was. I thought right now I'm just stressed and I'm tired because it was, I mean, I don't regret doing it for a minute, but the MA, it was really exhausting. It was full on. I mean, we had a module where it was an extended role play, basically. It's called Living History. And we went to the woods of Kent in February. It was ice and snow everywhere. And we lived there for 5 days as if it was 1649. So we were in character. Yeah, wow. We're doing your Civil War. We were in character from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. We were out in the woods all day in the snow, like making fire, cooking whatever beets and parsnips we could find, that stuff. It was intense.
Did so you at the have end of that, interactions yeah. with people who weren't in character between those hours?
Between those hours? I mean, from 5 or so p.m. until 8 a.m., we did get out of character. But if you mean there, no, we went when we knew that nobody else was going to be there.
Okay. No, that was the reason I asked the question. I'd be interested what happens when
that would be
modern
really
life
funny.
Interacts with...
That would be really funny.
Yeah.
No, we had the place to ourselves because it was some kind of camping site that usually scouts use, I think.
Okay.
And we knew, and presumably from the university had booked it for us. And it was in the middle of nowhere, so it's not somewhere you will randomly bump into people, especially in the dead of winter when it's absolutely freezing. So we had the place to ourselves to go
okay,
wild.
So you were safe.
1649.
You were safe to immerse yourself in the world. Did it feel weird when you came out of that? So at 5 p.m., when you then went back to normal life, did you have to adjust to being Nick?
Well, here's the thing. That was one of the signs that probably I might not want to do this to myself, the whole acting thing. I would be relieved and I would immediately snap back into Nick, like, okay, I want to go warm myself up now. I want to take a shower. And other people would be shell-shocked for a while afterwards. You almost couldn't talk to them. And then at the end of that module, most people were bawling their eyes out because it was such an intense experience for them. And a lot of them described it as they felt like they were leaving their characters behind now. Mm. They were abandoning their characters. They're abandoning that little world and that little village we had built in 1649. And I just felt relief. I was like, finally, I want to go back to civilization. I want Wi-Fi. I want to eat a burger. I want to be able to shower whenever I want. I felt relief coming out of that. I definitely had some interesting experiences and it pushed me to some limits, but I was relieved when that was over. I didn't feel like, oh no, I want to go back. And for probably a couple of weeks later, people would say, oh, I want to go back to 1649. I'd be like, no, 2012 is great. 1649, not so much.
My time traveling, I've done it. I've been there. It was fun, but yeah thanks.
it's a fun story to tell.
Yeah.
And I don't regret it, but that 5 days, that was my limit. At the end of that, I thought, I'm done with this. I want to go back home to 2012.
So I imagine, as you say, that you mentioned that was one of the reasons that you decided this really is enough, because a lot of people, not everyone does this, but a lot of people, when they go into acting, they do method acting and they really do immerse themselves in a character.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's not 8 to 5, it's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for months.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what that does to your head, especially if you're being a serial killer or, you know, something which is really the opposite to who you are.
Mm.
And you have to, I'm hoping that method actors aren't going around killing people, but they have to do all of the other things that go around with the mentality of a serial killer, that must make you feel just...
It must be awful. I mean, most drama schools, they teach the Stanislavski method, which is the opposite of method acting. So it's about transformation and becoming that person in the moment, and then you can leave it behind, like you take off a coat. So it wasn't extended. We didn't really consider it method acting because it was a clear beginning and end every day. It was like being on set, for example. You would have 10-hour days probably on set anyway, if you were filming somewhere. Or if you were doing a theater show, you would be rehearsing in the morning and then performing in the evening. So it was not considered method acting. We were not encouraged to actually be those people all the time. Because then it becomes a question of how much of that is acting, if you actually are that person off camera as well. Are you really acting, or are you fundamentally changing yourself? Because acting is supposed to be, I'm Nick, and then I step on the stage and boom, I'm Hamlet. Not, I actually am this Hamlet person in real life as well, and I walk around talking with thou and having skulls and talking to them in my free time.
No. It would be quite fun to watch, but
probably not very healthy.
At the same time, not healthy. That's it. It is interesting because sometimes people who say they do method acting, and you know, everyone talks about Daniel Day-Lewis. He is the prime example,
king of method actors.
Yeah, and it seems to work very well for him. He is, in my opinion, one of the best actors that's ever lived. So it does something. But at the same time, I think you're right to say that it must just completely mess up his life at times too. And I that's probably why he does so few films.
Maybe he does. He's a fantastic actor, but we don't know what's going on the inside. We know that it works well for him artistically. We have no idea how well it works for him mentally.
Yeah, that's true.
Physically, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, we've stopped talking about other people.
Why I didn't want to do it? What happened in between? But at the time of graduation, as I said, I decided that I don't think I want to do that to myself. That's just too insane. To work this hard and to expose myself like that emotionally, I get on a stage and bear my emotions and all that. And to do that for what? For free? And to be expected to work for free and to be considered as having an attitude if I don't want to do that and actually want to be able to pay my rent without also having to have like 85 side jobs at call centers where people are calling and yelling at me for things that I have no control over, which was very, very typical. Most of us did that stuff. And so I got back into teaching languages, and I was juggling a bunch of things at the same time. So I was, for the next couple of years, I thought, let me still give it a shot, just because now I've just graduated. I've got the most connections that I'm going to have probably in the acting industry. So you got to strike the iron while it's hot. So I still forced myself to do it for a couple of years, even though I didn't want to, which doesn't make any sense in retrospect. But at that point, I thought, yeah, but what if in a couple of years I want to do it? And at that point, I've burned all the bridges. I've lost all the contacts. I've gotten rusty and I can't act anymore, all that stuff. So I have to keep doing it. And maybe it will pay off in the long term. Maybe slowly I'll rediscover the joy for it. I felt like I had to do that. But after a couple of years doing that, so we're talking about maybe 2014, I thought, you know what? Mid-2014, I thought, you know what? No, I don't think I'm going to get any happier doing this. And this is getting in the way of everything else, because having that stuff where you're constantly either auditioning or rehearsing or performing, it gets in the way of your professional evolution in other ways, because it's hard to juggle, even as a language tutor or a translator, it is hard to be so inconsistent and to not be able to be dependable for your clients. And then if I wanted to get a part-time job as an employee on the side at a call center or serving drinks or whatnot, that's also hard. So it's all just a constant hamster wheel of stuff shifting around. And I feel like I'm underperforming at all three things that I'm doing with my life.
Rather than focusing on one and being brilliant at one, you were being average at best.
Exactly. So I thought, I'm going to pick the language stuff because that's by far the most profitable. I know that. This is what I have by far the most experience in. So I'll go for that. Then once that has laid down as a base, now let's say I have a stable income and I have some long-term clients and I managed to, you know, build enough of a presence here in the UK that I can, you know, charge more. And because I have more testimonials and more results to flaunt, then slowly I can work in the acting again.
And did that happen?
Well, that's the thing. As I started getting more established in the language tuition side of things, I realized that I don't want to go back to acting. I like having a reasonably stable income, at least compared to what I was making with acting, which was just all over the place. I like having some stability in my life. I like having a degree of control over my life because, yes, as a language tutor, you're also self-employed just like an actor, but you don't feel, at least I didn't, feel completely at the mercy of other people. Where there, as I said, as an actor, you're expected to basically prostrate yourself and be like, please like me, hire me, producer, director, whatnot. You're expected to play that game. And I will say that I don't have the personality to play that game. I was like, no.
If in your dream world, for example, or if in an imaginary world, you were able to strip away all of the business side of show business and just made it show, would you want to continue acting then?
No, I wouldn't.
You've gone off the idea now of even acting for fun.
Yeah, no. That's another big realization that I had is that I was using, and they warned us about that. Our head, of course, she's a very wise woman, and she really understands people. And she warned us at the beginning, first day, we had this big talk about, you need to make sure that you're doing this for the right reasons, the whole acting thing, because most likely you're not going to make much money. The wrong reasons would include things like needing to get all of this attention and approval, because she said, yes, it will work out in your favor business-wise, probably, but it will make you unhappy if you're just desperately trying to fill that hole inside of you. She described it as a wound, but I'm thinking of it as a hole. I'm thinking of it as if you constantly need this much external affirmation and validation that there's some part of you that's hollow. That's why in my mind, it's a hole. She called it a wound, but yeah. And interestingly enough, that's the term that they use in psychology as well, narcissistic wound. I was like, maybe she had read up on psychology to use that term. And she said, and the other reason is that you're not using it, and these can overlap, you're not using acting in lieu of psychotherapy. Because a lot of people, she said, they are drawn here because they have this wound inside them that won't heal. And they think that getting up on a stage and telling people, please, please love me, like me, look at me, applaud for me, that this is going to make them happier with themselves. But she said, but that's not. Because you'll see that the high, if you are wired like that, the high wears off quite quickly. Like, you'll get the applause, you'll feel good. Next day, you'll need your hit. You'll keep needing your hit like a
job.
Junkie.
It's an addictive job. Yeah. And as you say, you keep on needing more and more of it.
Yeah. And for me, it wasn't that. Yeah. It was, you are basically like a drug addict. You know, like a junkie there, getting your fix every day. And for me, it wasn't the former. So I wasn't, because I'm a huge introvert. I actually don't even like attention. I like people watching far more than I like socializing. And I was the second category of unhealthy, just as unhealthy. So I was using it in lieu of probably therapy. So I was using it to escape from a life that I didn't like. Mm-hmm. So the more productive thing maybe at the time would have been to go to a shrink. But instead, I dealt with my life and my demons by pretending to be someone else and leaving that life behind me and playing that little game of ostrich, basically. And when that clicked, that what I like most about this whole thing is that I get to step into this Peter Pan. This is not a judgment for other performers. This is what it was to me. It's not the same to everyone. But for me, it was a safe little bubble where I leave Nick behind and I become whoever, Hamlet, Richard II, whoever. Even if these were tragic characters, usually I got given the sad characters. Must be something morose about me. I don't know. And even if these characters were tragic, their story was fixed. So I knew how it was going to end. So it just didn't feel as bad as being myself. I know this sounds unhealthy, and it was. And when I realized that this is what's going on, I thought, okay, so the more productive thing would be to actually fix my life as opposed to find ever more inventive ways to run away from it by becoming other people. Mm-hmm. That's why I would not want to act today.
Because even that acting is not about fun for you. It's about diving into a completely different world. That makes sense, actually.
Yeah.
It must have been a hard realization when it hit.
Yeah. It was not fun. I thought, right, that's why I keep, once the novelty wore off, I just kept enjoying it less and less. And I thought, I remember many moments, but one moment in the last term when we were preparing for a big show where the agents and the producers are invited to come. Our head, of course, was yelling at me because she said, you don't want to be here. And it's very obvious. And I said, yeah, I don't want to be here. She said, yep, but you're an actor. I was like, not really, only title. So I don't want to be here. She was like, well, too late. Now you're just going to have to suck it up, not let your classmates down and go through with it. And I did it. But that was one of the moments where I realized, she's right. I don't want to be here. I don't want to be here. I don't want to be on stage with people looking at me. I don't want to keep pretending to be someone else. I can escape from my life. That's not healthy. You should be doing it because you love it. You should be doing it ideally because you enjoy the process, as opposed to because you're running from something else. And this is the lesser of two evils.
Uh-huh. To move from that then, to move from that realization to then go into teaching languages again, which was something which you didn't really want to do and other people told that you should do at university.
Yeah.
And you went back into.
I went back into it.
How did that feel? I know I am being a psychotherapist. How did that feel?
It felt great, actually. It felt like a relief. I was like, oh, finally, I don't have to wake up every morning and wonder which part of my soul I have to rip out and feed the audience today. It felt good. And as I said, it didn't feel like I had this little control, because in the show business, it's such a precarious business. You have, if you're at the beginning, if you're at the bottom, you have virtually zero control. Whereas that is just not true, is it, for all aspects of self-employment? No. It is not quite, I think, as bad as a language teacher, as a copywriter. Yeah, I'm sure it's not great in the beginning. You've got a lot of people who want you to work for free or for very cheap, and then will try to take advantage of you. But it's usually not as structured. Like, there's a whole system, like show business. This is how the social pyramid is. There's not a whole system, basically, where every single thing is rigged against you and you have no leverage, no negotiating power. You're expected to just beg for scraps and maybe you'll get them. That's basically, and maybe this is me being overly dramatic, but at the time, this is certainly how it felt. This is my lived reality, that I was expected to just prostrate myself and be like, oh, please, Mr. Producer, can I have a role? Yes, I'll do it for free just to show that I'm eager to work. And I didn't want to do that. I'm more business-minded than that, I think. I'm more practical than that. I was like, yeah, but I need to pay rent, though. What are you going to do about that? Yeah, so it felt like a relief actually getting back into an area that was more familiar, because the acting thing was still brand new. It was barely 2 years old at that point. And where I felt like I had more control and more predictability. Again, comparatively, it was not predictable or stable, but comparatively it was. So it actually felt good, and I never would have guessed that a few years before that.
That's interesting, because there's something to, I think, sometimes growing up, and there are certain parts that you rebel against, and sometimes what you're rebelling against isn't actually the thing itself. It's potentially everyone else telling you that you should be doing this thing. It's everyone telling you that you should be going to university. And that potentially was then when you went, well, I don't want to go to university. I don't want to teach languages. I don't want to be... All of it seems to combine into one, whereas when you come to your own realization a bit later down the line, it can feel different, I think. I don't want to speak for you. I realize I just have a little, but that seems to be kind of what you were getting at a little bit to me. It felt like.
Yeah. We are definitely in psychotherapy territory now. Yeah, I absolutely.
Sorry, it's my way.
Well, anyone who knows me well knows that I'm a control freak. So feeling like other people are trying to assume control over my life and make my choices for me and tell me, shut up, you're just going to do as I tell you, and that's that. That can definitely set me off. And that was a big factor. Now, in retrospect, it's not that there's something horrible. I mean, I don't want to do it. That's why I'm coaching people in public speaking now. But it's not like there's something fundamentally horrible about being a linguist, dealing with language and literature. It's not, you know, mining for diamonds or something. It's not backbreaking, life-endangering work. But at the time, a big factor was probably just the way that I ended up there. And the way that you end somewhere can really make a difference. There's a difference between you choosing it and just being forced into it and saying, this is your life now. Nope, you don't get a vote. You're just going to have to suck up and do it.
So that actually leads us into something that you have chosen and which we've barely mentioned up until this point, but we really need to, which is what you're doing now. So you moved, you had your dreams, you realized that you could be okay. And
they were not very productive dreams,
But then you came to this point where languages, you still, as much as you were liking them more and you had that sense of relief, they still weren't the ideal for you. Mm. So public speaking, tell us more about that.
Well, so I've been doing this for just under 2 years now, my new pivot, if I can use that overdone word now. So like late 2019. Yeah, it really has flown by. So after going back into the whole language tuition and translation thing, it was comparatively better. So in the beginning, that novelty was good, but then the novelty started wearing off, as it always does. And I realized that, yeah, but I'm still not really enjoying it that much. Yes, I'm not dreading it the way that I was dreading the whole acting thing. I'm not dreading it, but is that all there is? There's this nagging question of, is that as far as it goes? Like, yeah. So, get up, teach a few languages, blah, blah. It all felt kind of, it didn't really light me up. And then I struggled for a long time with this question of, maybe I'm fundamentally not the kind of person who's ever going to be lit up by his work, because some people live to work and some people just work to live. Yeah. Maybe I'm a work to live person. Maybe there is no job, because, and I think this is almost taboo to discuss these days on LinkedIn, where everything's hustle, 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 mission, passion, all of these buzzwords, right? You are supposed to be the live to work kind of person. Your work is supposed to be the center of your universe, the reason you wake up in the morning, what makes your heart sing. It can't just be work. It can't just be what you do, because, well, you need to do something. You're not likely to win the lottery statistically. And this is what finances, maybe the stuff that you really care about, like your mortgage, your kids' tuition, I don't know, traveling, learning new skills like languages, pottery, archery. And I struggled for years with that question of, what if that's all there is? Because it just doesn't matter what job I do, because maybe I'm someone who fundamentally isn't wired in that way that he will ever derive huge amounts of fulfillment or joy from work. So that's why I pivoted into public speaking coaching, because I thought, I want to give it one last shot and do something else, reinvent myself yet again, and see if this time I will feel some passion for what I'm doing. Yeah, I am feeling passion. I don't know if I'm a live. I still, honestly, this might be hubris, but I still don't think I'm a live to work person. I will say I love my job.
Okay.
Would I say that I couldn't possibly be happy if I didn't do public speaking coaching? No, not at this point. I'm going to be honest and say, if it hadn't worked out, I'm sure that I would have found something else to do with my life and been happy. I've found that there's more than one way to skin a cat.
What I find really interesting about what you're saying is, we actually, as part of what we do as a business, when we're focusing on people's brands, one of the key things we talk about is, why does your brand exist? What is the point of it? Why do people get up in the morning to go and work for you? Those kind of questions, which, if taken too far out of context, very much feed in to what you're talking about with the whole idea of live to work, live to work, live to work. You have to be the most passionate person in the world about your job. What I think's happened, though, is that unfortunately people have read, I'm not going to mention other people's names on here, but people have read books by certain people who I agree with a lot of their philosophies, but they've read them, and I personally believe quite often misunderstood them. The idea isn't supposed to be that everything you do has to be about your work. The idea is supposed to be that when you go to work, you actually feel good about it. You feel comfortable there. You want to be there. You want to make the most of it. And you want the company that you're working for to do the best it can, and for you to be the best person you can be within that company. When we're talking about why does this company exist, it's to motivate people to want to continue to work for the company. It's not to motivate people to not want to do anything else and to want to stop living their lives and to want to only ever think about being the administrator for that's ridiculous, that idea. But the idea is that admin person does love working for the company. They love what the company stands for. And if somebody compared that company to their competitors, they'll go, well, I wouldn't want to work for anyone else because this company is brilliant. But then they also love the income that comes in so that they can go out and watch a show in the evening, or they can go for drinks with their friends, or they can look after their kids. It's balance. And I actually get quite annoyed when people say, do you live to work or do you work to live? Because no, you do a bit of both. Just have some balance in your life. That's kind of where it works for me.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'm so happy we see eye to eye in that. Because I honestly feel like this is taboo to say, LinkedIn. It's just, it becomes a bit of an echo chamber of everything has to be mission driven and purpose driven. And yeah, as you said, you can have some intentionality behind what you do, but that doesn't mean that everyone needs to have this big mission or calling in life. Like for me, for the longest time, I felt like I had to almost go into the closet as someone who works to live as opposed to the other way around. Like I don't want to, I feel very disingenuous getting up on that virtual stage of LinkedIn and saying that I have a mission to transform the world. And by X date, I want to teach 1 million people how to ace their public. No, I like it. I'm good at it, thankfully, because of the drama training. And that's pretty much as far as the thought goes. I enjoy it more than any other work that I've done. And I can see some evolution happening in terms of where I can go with my business. That's, I'm playing it one step at a time. I don't see myself as a mission kind of person, period. It's just not how my brain works, I think.
I think we're on slightly different paths when we talk about that specifically, because I actually do feel relevance to missions and I do feel relevance to bigger purposes. Mm. But what I worry about is when people say that that should take over your life.
Yeah. So
a mission and a purpose, like I have lots of purposes, but the idea of having a mission within a company or having a mission, like, so if you had a kind of, people call it a North Star, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be something so grandiose, like I want to by X date, as you say, save the lives of 400,000 people on stage by 2030. Like that's my, it doesn't have to be as grandiose as that. It's less about looking out and worrying about what other people want from you and looking in and going, what is it that wakes me up every morning? And so it's not about this big kind of like, I have to get to this point, but it is about, well, why do I care about what I'm doing? And it's a simple question of constantly asking why.
Mm.
And so why do I want to wake up in the morning and do public
speaking coaching? Yeah.
And so when you're thinking about that, you're then thinking, well, what do I enjoy about it? And you think about things like, well, I really enjoy the results that I get when other people are able to speak and then I'm in and erring throughout their conversations. I don't know what you enjoy. I'm just guessing.
No, you're spot on. It is so satisfying. I always get this buzz and I always get this high after a session where someone comes in and they have their speech or their presentation or their elevator pitch for their video, for example, and they start, hi, I'm so-and-so, and they end, and it's great, and like, hi, I'm so-and-so, and I help these people get that, and this is how you get in touch, or let me tell you my story, or they make a little presentation because they have a webinar, and when they come in, and they're shaking like a leaf, or they look like a deer in the headlights, or how many metaphors can fit into one sentence, or they speak into the, or they speak into the camera, and they're just, because stress manifests differently in people. Some people, they get hyperverbal and hyperphysical, so they're like, they're shaking and twitching. But other people, it goes the other way, and they go completely deadpan. And they think they're speaking to the audience with enthusiasm, and they're like, hi, I'm Nick, and I do, right? So when you see it go from that to something that can connect with the audience, it is so satisfying. I always get a high, like afterwards, I'm like, woo! After the session, I have to do a little victory dance because I have so much energy bursting out of me.
You see, though, what just happened there?
Mm.
Your whole body transformed when you talk about that. I saw you come closer to the camera. I saw the excitement pulse through you when you were talking about it. That there is why we talk about your why. When we say, why do you do what you do? Why do you care?
That's it. It's not a wild mission to power 1 million people by 2030. It's just, this is the part that I enjoy. For me, this is enough. For some gurus of LinkedIn or other social media, it might not be enough. Well, that's their problem. I don't really care. For me, this is, I don't know if I can call that a mission or a purpose, but I can say that there is spark now and there is passion and there is a lot of joy.
I think actually part of the problem is that there's too much vocabulary around. There's too much. I always talk about your why because that's kind of where I focused for a very long time.
Mm.
You know, other people talk about purpose, historically purpose, mission, vision, all of that kind of stuff. But they're just words. What really matters is what drives you. And you clearly are driven by what you do. I can feel it. When you talked about languages earlier, I didn't feel you being driven by languages. When you talked about acting, I felt you explained an historical drive, but again, I also felt like a sapping of energy almost when you talked about it to an extent. Mm. When you talked about this, you lit up. You completely lit up. So that's what I mean by a why. That's what I mean by like how you motivate people.
Yeah.
And if you have a whole company feeling the same about that, then suddenly you've got a business that is going to thrive, I think.
Yeah, that's pretty damn great. So that I'm happy that I took the plunge and switched over into that just before Corona hit, I guess, only a few months before the pandemic hit.
Good timing.
Yeah, fantastic timing. Couldn't have gone better. But I really wanted to test that theory about am I live to work, work to live. I realize that it doesn't matter. I know that I'm happy now. So that's, I don't need to, I think I'm work to live, as in, as I said, if something, knock on wood, would happen and this public speaking coaching didn't work out, I'm sure that I would find some other way to be happy with my life. I would find something else to be passionate about. And I think a lot of people see it as it just has to be this or else. And actually I was talking with a psychologist, and I said that I feel quite, that was a while ago, I feel quite intimidated that I don't seem to have this wild passion purpose that a lot of business owners seem to have on LinkedIn, where every single thing, this is what makes their heart sing, this is what makes them up in the morning. Whoa. And she said, actually, you're not likely to fall behind because of that, because if it is what your life revolves around, if you do live to work, that can make it really hard to detach from it. So if your business fails, you will see it as I'm a failure, or I now have no purpose. Whereas if with you, knock on wood, if it failed, you would just reinvent yourself again. That's like the story of your life. You're like, you keep rising from your ashes. You just keep reinventing yourself as something else if it goes wrong. And that is, in the moment, it doesn't feel great, obviously, when you have to reinvent yourself. But in the long term, it makes you more resilient. Whereas the people are so tied to that. Everything is, that is their hashtag mission, hashtag purpose. That's going to be really hard if it doesn't work out for them. They're going to have a lot of trouble being happy in any other way. So I thought, okay, that's a good thought to have. I do think that I can be, even though I love it, I do think that in a different life, I could have gone a different path, done something else like sliding door style, where at some point I would have taken a different path. I do think that I could still have ended up happy, even if this isn't what I was doing.
I can 100% believe that. And I think you're right to say it's probably healthy to, again, I think it's important to really care about what you do and to enjoy it and to love it, but at the expense of the rest of your life, that probably isn't very healthy. So I think it's a nice balance that you have. However, the other side to what you do, it's not all about you, right? It's about all of your clients and how you help them. So how do you help your clients? You've already mentioned some of those things.
Yeah, how do I help them? So I use, my training is, to geek out now, is highly technical. So it's based on the training that I received at drama school. Highly technical. It's about your voice, your expressions, your body language, how you use the space. Less so these days because there's not that much space to use in virtual environments most of the time. But, you know, at some point we're going to meet face-to-face with people again, hopefully. And it is really actionable, I would say. It is not inner or cognitive, because what I found was that there is a bit of a gap in the market when it comes to public speaking. Sure, there's a lot of coaches out there and there's a lot of books. And if you go to Amazon, because I did that as market research for myself, just wild inspiration. And I checked out pretty much all of the top books that you see on public speaking, the top reviewed ones. They focus on inner stuff, about confidence, about mindset, about all that stuff. If you check out the 5-star reviews, it's always about, oh, after reading this book, I feel so much more confident. Or after working with that coach, I feel so much more confident. Thanks, you know, Nick. And I thought, but that's not what we were taught at drama school. We were taught that it's all about the audience. It's not about yourself. You're not showing up to feel feelings. You're showing up to give, to transmit, to teach, to gift something to your audience. So it's very much based on that philosophy. And I have people do stuff as opposed to feel stuff. They will feel stuff at some point, probably on their own, but we don't focus directly on any of that inner stuff. There is no module in my course where I sit and I'm like, okay, today we're going to clear your limiting beliefs and unlock your mindset and disruptively, whatever, rejig your inner monologue. There's none of that. There's just stuff about what you said. I would be curious to see it, say, that way and that way. And we play around with it a little bit. And, oh, this way it's more impactful.
And whether it's a feeling or if it's something tangible, you want to be empowered. You want to go away feeling empowered. You want to feel educated, entertained.
Yeah.
If you have all exactly. those things, then you'll be.
So it's all about focusing on the audience and making it about them. So not saying I feel this and I feel that, but if I say this way, the audience is going to get that message. Whereas if I say the exact same word in a different way, the audience is probably gonna lose me because I look like I'm contradicting myself. It's all about that technical stuff that makes a difference.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Mm. Now, I have seen, we've only met for the first time today, which is incredible, but yeah. I have seen lots of your videos on LinkedIn and all of the other ways that you interact as well, and they're powerful. It is clear that you are very good at what you do and you understand technique. And it's also clear that if people need help with their public speaking, that you are a great person to go to, but they can't go to you if they don't know where you are. So where can people
Where can I be found in this world? You can find me on my LinkedIn profile, which is where I probably spend most of my time online. So that's, can we throw a link or should I spell it out? Because it's a very long surname.
There's going to be links in the show notes. So there's going to be links.
So it will be Nick Diakonostasis. I'm trying to remember if it's a dash or a slash. It should be a dash. Let me just quickly check. It would be a dash, wouldn't it? So Diakanastasis. Yes, it is a dash. Nick dash Diakonostasis. And Nick is with an N-I-C-K. Because a lot of people will just write N-I-C. I'm like, but that's short for Nicole, isn't it? Anyway, that might be a cultural thing. And you can also find me on my website. So that's Nick Diakan. So not the whole thing. No dashes, no full stops between. You can also, in theory, find me on my YouTube channel, but it's new. And right now, I don't have any stuff other than the stuff already put on LinkedIn. But I am going to be creating longer videos specifically for YouTube soon.
Okay, perfect. And also sometimes it's easier to find videos on YouTube than it is on LinkedIn. So
I know, you don't have to scroll as long. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. I remember trying to look even for some of my own posts from over a year ago, and it took me about a year to get to them.
Yeah.
So we will put all of that on show notes to make sure that people can find you. Before we leave, just so everyone knows, I will be sharing a story as I always do at the end of this podcast. But to finish off, I just want to say, Nick, it has been genuinely an absolute pleasure to find out more about you and to hear your stories. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure. The time just flew by.
It really did. It really did. I just realized how long we've been on for.
Yeah. I was like, whoa, that was fast. Yeah.
There's going to have to be maybe a couple of edits. No, we'll just leave it be as long as it is. I like it like that.
I like it this way too.
Okay, now time for a story. Opening my eyes and seeing the familiar setting of my childhood bedroom brought a mixture of feelings. For 6 months, I had been waking up in a different bed in a new and strange world, not knowing where I was, what I would see, or who I would meet. And every morning, I felt an incredible excitement for the new day ahead. That's not to say that travelling doesn't have its downsides. Sleeping on a bus with little legroom on a 20-hour journey is not the most comfortable way to live, and being without friends and family can often take its toll. It all seems worth it, though, when you see your first penguin in the wild, or meet people from a completely different culture. So, how should I have felt when I returned to my childhood home, not knowing what the future had in store? I guess I could have been miserable. Nothing really seemed exciting. I'd been everywhere in my hometown. I'd met many people there already, and I had no expectations of chasing wildlife or eating sopa de Paraguay or some other exotic cuisine. A part of me definitely did feel sad. As I watched the rain slamming against the kitchen window, I thought about lying on the beach in Rio de Janeiro, or walking through the hills of Sierra de la Pantana. But another part actually felt excited. It was a different type of excitement, not the instant hit that you get from each daily wonder. Instead, an anticipation that there is a whole new life waiting for me. The potential of a brand new career with all of its ups and downs, the trials, the tribulations, the challenges that I was yet to experience. At heart, I'm an explorer. I love to discover new and incredible parts of life. But what I have often forgotten is that I still have so much to discover about myself. Of course, I will always miss traveling. But now that I've got the opportunity to be back with my friends and family, is home truly sweet? You know, I think it is.
You've just been listening to the Storytelling with Puck podcast. We'll be back very soon, so make sure you subscribe and catch up on any of the episodes you've missed.